Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome inside ESPN Studios. This is the Spencer Wilson Show, and yes, I'm your host, Spencer Wilson. Man, we got a fun one for you today. Of course, our pal Terry will join us over the phone to talk some Monday Night Football last night between the Cowboys and the Giants. We'll also look at Week 2 of the NBA. Now that we are officially into Week 3, we'll take a look at how some of the standings have changed and which teams continue to play well. And then a certain NFL team was involved in some talks that have become public about relocating across the pond. So I'm going to give you my two cents worth on that. But first, it is a big night tonight. Not only is it a start of all of college basketball season, but Nevada plays tonight, both the men and the women playing home games. Tonight at Mackey Stadium, the women will host St. Mary's at 3 o'clock, and the men will host Utah at 7:30. So it is going to be an exciting night and day and night for Nevada basketball here in Reno. And a lot of promise from both teams coming off their exhibition seasons. Nevada men's team going 2-0 in their exhibition season. The women's game just going, the women's team going 1-0, but having a huge win over William Jessup in that game, playing extremely well. But let's start talking here about the men's team. They will be playing Utah. This will be the second time Nevada and Utah plays each other. The first time last year, December 29th of 2018, they played in Salt Lake, and Nevada was able to beat the Utes 86-71. And looking at the stat line, it was kind of your classic last year Musselman Nevada team. They really neck and neck through the first half. They had a one-point lead over Utah, 38-37. And then came out in the second half and really started to separate. They outscored Utah 48-34 there in the second half. They went on to win 86-71. And that's really who that team was last year, and that was no surprise. They were a second-half team. They kind of felt you out in the first half. Just they tried to make sure they didn't make too many mistakes. They weren't trailing. And as soon as they came out in the second half, it was like a boxer in the last three rounds. They knew what you wanted to do. They knew how they wanted to set you up, and they just had the right counter for every move. And we saw, again, a little bit of that in Nevada's first exhibition game this year against Cal State East Bay when they had a 27-15 at the lead at the half, and they came out and put up 54 points in the second half. And I feel like that was more, in this case scenario, of a team with its first game under a new head coach, new players trying to work everything out, get comfortable with each other, get a good rhythm down offensively, get some good communication down defensively. Because then if you look at their second exhibition game against Colorado Christian, two very similar halves, 42 points in the first half, 44 points in the second half. And I feel like that's more of what we'll see this season from Nevada. They might have a first or second half that's better than the other, but they seem to be a more complete team, especially in that second game against Colorado Christian. They seem to be a more complete team from start to finish. It wasn't so much that they struggled in the first half and they came out and blew it up in the second. They had a really solid first half. Their offense looked crisp. They looked like they were making good moves. That you could already tell they had seemed more comfortable with each other after that first exhibition game. So tonight, as they host Utah, it's going to be a tough matchup, which is what you want. I mean, for Nevada, the fact that you have your first four games here at home is huge. And Utah, Loyola Marymount, Texas Arlington, USC, those are four good teams that are coming into Reno. So to be coming off the preseason that they are in a stadium and in an arena that it can get loud, it can get rowdy, it can get passionate, it makes it tough for teams to come in here and try to win. And especially tonight with a whiteout against Utah, it could be the start of another very special season here at Nevada, and we have a coach in Steve Alford who knows what that's like. He knows what it's like to work in a bigger market in Los Angeles. He knows what it's like to work in that kind of pressure and be the new coach at a new school, and I think he's looking forward to it. I think he's got this team looking forward to it, and I'm excited to see what happens. I'm going to be on the board for the women's game, so I'll be able to kind of get home and get settled and try to find it. It will be on CBS Sports Network. If you can get to a TV and you'd like to watch it, CBS Sports Network will carry it. But, of course, ESPN Radio 94.5 FM will be broadcasting that game here on the radio. Mr. John Ramey, I believe, will be on the broadcast tonight for the Utah game. So tune in for that, whether on the radio or on TV. But a great start for Nevada. It's a game where you have a quality opponent in Utah. It's a Pac-12 team. If you come out and really make a statement in this first game, granted, they could have another rough first half. Not a rough first half, but they could have a bit of a slower first half. And I think as a fan base, we just have to mentally prepare for that. This is the first true game of the regular season, and they could stumble here and there through that first half. But I feel like if they can get a win at home, start the season against a powerful Utah team, a good Utah team, and that can set them up for a great start to the season, especially with these first four games at home, and you go on the road to Davidson, which is a talented school over there in North Carolina. So I think this is a great start for Nevada. They can work this into a great confidence and momentum builder as they move forward in these first four home games of their season, and really can't wait to see what this men's team can do. And then, of course, there's the women's team, who is coming off an outstanding exhibition game against William Jessup. I mean, they nearly doubled William Jessup's score in this game. Nevada beat him 102-56. I mean, you look across the board here at each quarter totals, and this Nevada defense stood stout. I mean, 17 points was the most they gave up in a quarter, and that was the third quarter. But 14 in the second and fourth, just 11 points out of the gate in the first. This Amanda Levin's team has always been able to play solid defense. It's their offense that has had some waverings in the past, but this I feel like her teams are always defensively sound. They're always ready to bite down their mouthpiece. They're always ready to get out there and make it tough for the other team to score, and just like they seem to really enjoy playing defense. And sooner or later, that is going to translate over to offense. We saw that in a lot of a fair amount of games last year, where this team, and I've talked about it, Coach Levins has talked about it, John Ramey has talked about it, where they had a lot of young women and a lot of young players that were getting baptized by fire last season that now have all that confidence and all that experience and just ready to get out there with some new players on their team. And they looked exceptionally well in that first game. I mean, to break the 20-point barrier in all four quarters is great. They put up 29 in the first, 28 in the second, and, of course, 24 in the third and 21 in the fourth. So this is a team that can show they can score. They have defense that can step up and be ready to play. And again, you want to talk about a solid first game of the season, Nevada and St. Mary's. In Nevada, it's been a while since these two teams have met, but they've stayed competitive with St. Mary's in the last three meetings. They've had three total meetings with St. Mary's. The first one was in 2002. That was here in Reno, Nevada. It's been the only game thus far before tonight that has been played in Reno. And Nevada won it 72-55. It's been the biggest win of the three games so far. And the next two games were all in Moraga, California. In 2003, St. Mary's beat them 76-73. But again, a three-point loss there. Nevada stayed in it. And then about 8 years ago in 2011, March of 2011, once again in Moraga, California, Nevada able to beat St. Mary's 65-62. So the last two meetings have been competitive. They've been tight. I imagine this game might be just the same. Coach Levin's going to have this team ready to go. She's going to have them pumped up. She's going to have them psyched in front of a home crowd this afternoon there at Lawler. And, man, you just hope that they can get off to a great start again, because this is a team that has a lot of talent. And, again, just like the men's team, with St. Mary's and Sacramento State coming in here, it's a great way to start the season. And then going at Utah Valley and at Portland State, they also have just a solid start to their year and some good early tests for this team to see how they can perform under pressure on the road and at home. And I think Amanda Levin's going to have this team absolutely raring to go. But, of course, it's not just the start of Nevada's basketball season. We have a ton of college basketball going on tonight, including the State Farms Championship Champions Classic involving Duke, Kansas, Kentucky, and Michigan State, the top four teams in the country. You can't beat that. And I know it's a little early to be looking at the bracket and bracketology, but it's something that I really enjoy to see how teams kind of move around. And they did release the first bracketology of this season yesterday. And just looking at that, no surprise who the top four teams are. Again, they're the top four teams in the rankings as well. You have Michigan State, Kentucky, Kansas, and Duke, which are for the top. I mean, those are four of the biggest programs in college basketball in the country. And, I mean, Michigan State, what more can you say? They're going to have just an outstanding year. They're set up to Cassius Winston, outright leader right now for Big Ten Player of the Year. Could be National Player of the Year as well. Aaron Henry playing really well for Michigan State. And how is Kansas going to handle their season this year? Coming off kind of the off-season scrutiny, legal issues with the NCAA, the recruiting issue, whatever it may be, whatever it was for Kansas. But Bill Self has come out and said that that is going to help focus this team, and they're going to play with a new sense of direction, just be ready and raring to go to prove people wrong this season. And Devin Dotson, of course, one of the better point guards in the country. We'll see how he can operate with this team and control the offense. And, of course, Udoka Azubuike coming back to Kansas, returned for this next season, getting ready to kind of lock it down in the paint again for the Jayhawks. And then you have Florida at three, who was putting together a very nice team this year. And, of course, they're going to be relying mostly on that Virginia Tech transfer, Kerry Blackshear Jr., who is a great talent. He's somebody that you would imagine playing in the SEC. I feel like he's really going to give this Florida Gators another look. And, I mean, SEC Player of the Year, possibly, in Kerry Blackshear Jr., if they can get him going, get him really flowing through this offense. And I can imagine they're going to try and use him in every which way possible just because he is that good of a player and he has that much talent for this team. And then, of course, there's Kentucky. Calipari, of course, always puts together a talented team. More returners than usual for Kentucky, it seems like. And just some big names, Ashton Hagans, EJ Montgomery, Emmanuel Quickly, some of those guys that are just coming back that are ready to just rip and tear at that SEC and once again give Kentucky this run to try and make it there. And, of course, also in the SEC is Arkansas. We'll see how Musselman does in his first year in the big conference down there in the Southeastern Conference. And I feel like Arkansas might have some good wins this year, but I feel like for the most part, it's not going to be a year worth remembering in a lot of ways. But, of course, time will tell there. And then looking at some of the number two seeds here in bracketology to start the year, again, no surprise with North Carolina having an outstanding program as usual with Roy Williams there. They've got some good grad transfers in Justin Pierce and Christian Keeling. And Cole Anthony, who's one of the better high school players on this team and one of the better ones in the nation last year in the recruiting class. So we'll see what North Carolina can do there. And then Louisville as well in the mix, hanging around there in the top 10. They return some good, tough talent in Jordan Nwora. And again, one of a great ACC players all up there. And again, discussion, one of those all ACC team members. And Louisville is going to try and hold their own with the Duke and the North Carolinas and see what they can do this year. But they could win the ACC. Don't put it past Louisville this year at all to be up there with Duke and North Carolina contending for that conference. I could see Louisville pulling off a couple shockers this year throughout the season. And then I mentioned Duke, but I totally forgot to actually talk about Duke because Coach K, another excellent recruiting class, but when you lose guys like Zion and you lose the star, big star lottery players of last year, how does that change Duke? How is that going to affect Duke? And again, I don't think it's anything they really have to worry about. They have great players like Vernon Carey Jr., Trey Jones, guys that can always step into programs like Duke because you know they're going to recruit guys that they are well aware and confident can step into these roles. So Duke, I think, might have a little bit of a drop-off at overall performance, but nothing that's going to stop them from being one of the better teams in the country and, again, pushing the Final Four this year. And then Maryland. Maryland, one of the better teams this year, one of the better surprises this year, also coming in at a two seed in the first bracketology of the season. And again, three players that can really help lead this team through a tough Big Ten conference this year. Anthony Cowan Jr., Jalen Smith, Aaron Wiggins. I mean, there are guys, again, on this team that can make difference, big difference night in and night out for the Terps. So we'll see what they can get done this season. But those are the ones and two seeds of bracketology heading into this season. So again, we'll see how the Champions Classic goes tonight. Should be a lot of fun. And then with Nevada's basketball season starting, you know that's going to be entertaining as well. All right, when we come back from the break, we will discuss Monday Night Football, what went down in East Rutherford, New Jersey, and how it shapes the Giants and the Cowboys moving forward. All that coming up on the Spencer Wilson Show on ESPN Radio 94.5 FM.
Is your technology infrastructure meeting the demands of your customers, your employees, you? How does your network scale to support your growth plans? With distribution hiding behind every corner, it's time you benefited from a network and security provider that will guide your organization through rapid technology change. Blackfoot, here to enable what's next. Visit blackfoot.com/SDWAN to learn more.
Well, week 9 of the NFL season is now officially in the book with the conclusion of Monday Night Football last night from East Rutherford, New Jersey, as we had an NFC East battle between the Dallas Cowboys and the New York Giants, and a pretty surprising start to this game. The fact that the Giants really had the upper hand on the Cowboys throughout the first half really made the Cowboys sweat and made them really work for everything they had. I mean, who saw Dak Prescott's first pass coming out of the gate as just a blatant interception? Didn't even seem like he saw the defender right there just waiting for him to throw the ball and jump up and intercept it. And he did manage to throw for 3 touchdowns in that game, but that was a very surprising start to see the Giants come down, quick 4-play drive. Obviously didn't get a whole lot out of it, just 5 yards, but I was able to get a field goal on the board, go up 3-0, and then the Dallas Cowboys, which honestly thinking about that first Giants drive was really kind of the story of the Giants in this game. They were able to move the ball well, but as soon as they got in any kind of threatening position, they just kind of tripped over themselves and allowed Dallas to not necessarily make easy stops by any means, but didn't really push Dallas. When they got close to the end zone, they got into the red zone, Dallas was able to really kind of control tempo and kind of flip the script on the Giants whenever they were able to get close to scoring and putting points on the board, and for the most part really held them to just field goals. Because like I said, Aldrick Rosas got a 21-yard field goal with a little over 90 seconds or so into the game. And then the Dallas Cowboys, after an 11-play drive, set Brett Maher up for a 35-yard field goal. And 3-3 at the end of the first quarter was kind of a head-scratcher. I mean, I imagined it would be a relatively close game. I thought it would be a 10-13-point game. And for it to be tied at 3, I expected more out of each offense there, and especially the Dallas Cowboys offense there in the first quarter. But again, kind of tip your cap to the way the Giants came out and started this game, because they started it really, really strong. And in the second quarter, again, really able to open it up and control tempo to start the second. Cody Latimer was able to catch a 1-yard pass from Daniel Jones, but then in typical Giants style this year, the PAT was missed. And not just missed, but it's so much, I don't want to say easier, but you see it so much more where balls just drift off and completely miss it. To hit the actual upright of a goalpost, I mean, I don't think you should award any points for that, but that's pretty impressive. When you miss a field goal by hitting probably the smallest item on the field that's not the ball or a pad or whatever, that's pretty impressive. So to miss a field goal by hitting off the upright, a heartbreaker, but as a fan, I'm always like, it's pretty impressive to hit it right on the upright. But New York, then, of course, almost at the end of the second quarter, just under 3 minutes to go, got another field goal, had a 12-3 lead. I can't remember exactly if the Black Cat got on the field 9-3 right before they kicked the field goal, if it was right after the field goal, but right around that time, 9-3, 12-3, right in that area of the second quarter, a Black Cat appears on the field. Where it came from, how it got into the stadium, nobody knows. But, I mean, could you have planned it any differently? For the Giants to come out, have the start of the game where they seem to be dominating the Dallas Cowboys, and then all of a sudden this Black Cat appears, and it literally starts going downhill for the Cowboys, or not for the Giants, from that point on. Because the Cowboys come back, get a touchdown just under a minute to go. Now it's 12-10. Turnover from the Giants. Now the Cowboys are able to get a 52-yard field goal while time expires in the first half. So it was 9 or 12 to 3. Black Cat shows up. Now the Giants are going into halftime down 13-12. I mean, you cannot write some of this stuff sometimes the way that happens. And then, I mean, they literally were cursed. It feels like that is literally what happened to the Giants. It feels like they were literally cursed in this game after coming off at such a great start. Then they come out in the third quarter. Nothing really for the first 10 or so minutes of that quarter until Dallas gets another field goal, go up 16-12. New York able to hold in there, hang in there with a field goal of their own. Now it's 16-15. And even at that, 16-15, it still didn't feel like the Giants were really as in it as it looked. You know, I mean, their offense had really struggled throughout the game. The one touchdown they were able to get, of course, the botched PAT, didn't feel like they were going to ever get enough done in that game to surpass Dallas. And then we got to the fourth quarter, and it was essentially over from that point on. I mean, pretty early on into the fourth, Michael Gallup caught that 15-yard pass from Dak Prescott. Now it's 23-15 again. The Giants only able to get 3 points on the board, not getting into the end zone, 23-18. Again, that five-point game, I was thinking, hey, one possession, you know, they still got a little under 12 minutes to go here in the fourth quarter. Who knows? The Giants, if they can get a stop and get the ball back, but they were not able to get a stop as Dallas put together 2 really good touchdown drives after that New York field goal. Of course, Amari Cooper's 45-yard touchdown pass he caught from Dak Prescott, finally showing a little bit of life to that offense, made it 30-18. And then Jordan Lewis, the 63-yard fumble return. I mean, this defense made some big plays, probably none bigger than that to really ice it. 37-18 Dallas with 6 seconds left. I mean, it was essentially over already, down 12 points for New York, but that touchdown is going to add, you know, pour salt in the wound on New York and make Dallas feel that much better about themselves moving forward. Because now, essentially, even though Philadelphia is 5-4 and Dallas is 5-3, it feels like Dallas is really set in that division as the division leader. Philly's played some good games. They were able to hold off a charge from Chicago, but Carson Wentz and that offense haven't looked as good as they did a couple years ago before Wentz started going through these injuries. New York Giants with Daniel Jones, obviously 2-7. Their season's really starting to slip away. The Redskins' season at 1-8 is essentially over with. So Dallas right now, even though 5-3 coming off this win against the Giants, looking like the kind of team that is ready to take on the responsibility of a division leader and ready to kind of flex their muscle moving forward. And they'll have a great chance for doing that with their schedule coming up. They have the Vikings coming up next at home. That'll be a good test for them at the Lions. Detroit at home this year. I've said it just seems like a different kind of competitive team able to put it together than at the Patriots. So the next three games for the Giants are going to be good telling games against Minnesota, Detroit, and New England. Three talented teams, two of which in their conference, of course, New England in the AFC. But it'll be interesting to see how they can manage it, how they move forward. Same with the Giants. They got the Jets coming up. Giants are going to be the quote-unquote road team, but that's the Battle of MetLife Stadium there in East Rutherford, New Jersey. You also have the Jets. Then you have the Bears. So you have two games there where the Giants could win. At Jets, I could see them winning that game. New York Jets have nothing special going on after that upset win over Dallas. They haven't been able to put anything together. Then at the Bears, who knows? I would hope that Chicago at Soldier Field can bounce back nicely from that game against Philadelphia and put up a fight against the Giants and possibly get a win. But this is going to be a good stretch for the Giants as well to possibly get back into it, because then after the Jets and the Bears, you have to go to Lambeau to play Green Bay after that, and that's always an incredibly tough place to try and get a win for any team when you go into Lambeau Field. So it'll be interesting to see how those two teams really kind of pick themselves up these next three stretches. I feel like Dallas's stretch is a lot tougher than the Giants' stretch. So we'll see what those two teams, what they tell us about themselves coming out of those three games. And then I was talking about it yesterday on the radio here on the show about how excited I was to see the running back matchup in that game. I thought Ezekiel Elliott and Saquon Barkley were going to be the tell-alls for how those offenses operated in their game, and no surprise, Dallas won. I mean, Ezekiel Elliott, although he didn't get a rushing touchdown, still produced very well with 23 carries and 139 yards, and just able to move the ball. And what's so much fun about watching these two backs is they're two different backs with just incredible sets of skill, because I feel like Saquon Barkley is more the muscle guy. He's got speed, and he can move, he can break ankles, but between those two, I feel like Barkley is way more the guy just to put his hand on your chest and just push you to the ground as you try to tackle him, whereas Elliott's going to be more of the guy to be a little more shifty. He's going to look for the cuts, he's going to look for the spins. Not to say he doesn't like contact, but he's not the kind of guy that I would imagine is looking to put his head down more than he's looking to break ankles like Saquon Barkley is. So that's what I was excited to see in the game last night, and really just didn't get a lot from Saquon. I mean, 14 carries for 28 yards, nothing really going there, no touchdowns for him, and then 6 receptions for 67 yards. He did lead the team in receiving, but again, no touchdowns. So to keep Barkley out of the end zone, that's huge for any defense against the Giants, because he is essentially how that offense goes. And even though Elliott didn't get into the end zone, he was still able to be a big part of the offense in moving the ball. I mean, 23 carries to Saquon's 20 touches, period. And I understand why you use Barkley in the running and the passing game, but I would like to see him get more than 14. I'd like to see him up by closer to Elliott. Get him in that 20-25 carry range, and really kind of allow him to try and get more than just 2 yards a carry. And some of that's because he is a muscle man or a strong running back, so he wants to try and go up the middle and go through guys. But when you have 28 yards on 14 carries with just a 2 yard average, I mean, his long run of the game was 8. That's not good. I mean, Daniel Jones had a longer run than Saquon Barkley did. That can't be a stat that makes the Giants front office and the coaching staff feel good about themselves or about that game plan. So I was looking for the matchup between Elliott and Barkley, and unfortunately, Barkley, I don't know if, I mean, I feel like he was given a fair opportunity with 20 touches, but I feel like Elliott, the way he was using the offense last night, was definitely set up for more success and had some more success. So if the Giants are going to try and turn this around in the second half of their season and try and get a couple more wins under their belt, I think you're going to have to get a little more creative with Saquon Barkley instead of just handing it off and letting him try to go up the middle. Use him on a sweep, pitch the ball to him, toss the ball to him, let him kind of get out in a little more space before he has to try and have contact with somebody or try to make somebody miss. But I enjoyed this game. I thought it was a good game from Dallas's perspective. Again, still looking for some more of those nail-biter finishers in the primetime games this year. But overall, I would say Dallas definitely is feeling better about themselves coming off this game. And the fact that Dak was not sacked last night is huge for that offensive line. If you can give Dak time to sit back there and pick a defense apart. I mean, he had 257 yards did Dak Prescott last night through the air. And so when you don't have your quarterback under pressure like that, because Daniel Jones sacked 5 times, when you're trying to get your offense going, when Barkley's not getting as explosive, he had some good runs, but he's not having as explosive of a run as he's had in the past, you got to give Daniel Jones time. And to be sacked 5 times just isn't good. A lot of that came, too, in the first half of the game, but still got to give Daniel Jones more time back there when you have a young quarterback who's trying to figure stuff out. But I think, again, good game for Dallas. It was an opportunity lost for the New York Giants after the first half. Really the first quarter and a half that they had put together. But great win for Dallas, and we'll see how these two teams can go now through the next few games. And, of course, don't forget, Week 10 starts in a couple days on Thursday Night Football with the AFC West rivalry of the Raiders and the Chargers. Can't wait to talk about that in a couple of days. But when we come back from the break, we are through 2 weeks of the NBA season. So we will look at how the standings and stats have changed in those first 2 weeks coming up after the break here on the Spencer Wilson Show on ESPN Radio 94.5 FM.
Is your technology infrastructure meeting the demands of your customers, your employees, you? How does your network scale to support your growth plans? With distribution hiding behind every corner, it's time you benefited from a network and security provider that will guide your organization through rapid technology change. Blackfoot, here to enable what's next. Visit blackfoot.com/SDWAN to learn more.
Alrighty, 2 weeks of the NBA season are in the book as we get ready to start week 3. And we have had some interesting teams make some rather surprising early season runs. We've had a fair amount of jostling in the standings, which you would expect in the first bit of the season. Everyone kind of getting straightened out, getting their idea of starters and reserve players, some injuries. Also, with how few games teams have played thus far, a win or a loss can, bounce you around by 3 or 4 spots. But nonetheless, as of this morning, as of the end of week 2, before week 3 has gotten started, here are the standings here of how the teams have kind of moved around. So we'll start with the top 4 in the East. Miami moved up 2 spots from 3rd to 1st at 5-1. They hold that spot now over Philadelphia, and Miami playing really well. I mean, they have Jimmy Butler there, and they seem to be getting really good offense around him and a good feel for that team, and they seem to be really holding their own in a Eastern Conference that looks pretty stacked with Philly and Milwaukee. Toronto is the defending champs. Brooklyn obviously still without KD, but with Kyrie. Milwaukee with the MVP on that team and Giannis Antetokounmpo. So around all of that, Miami has still found a way to be number 1 in this conference and continue to push these other teams. And moving up 2 spots into 1st right now, this is a Miami Heat team that looks very game and is looking to possibly disrupt this Eastern Conference this year. But then again, the 3 kind of usual suspects are behind them, rounding out the top 4 in the Eastern Conference. Philadelphia has dropped a spot. They were number 1 in the East last week. They're number 2 in the East this week, or after week 2. They are number 2 in the East, 5-1, suffering their first loss last night to the Phoenix Suns. And we will get to Phoenix, because that is probably the most pleasant, the biggest pleasant surprise I've gotten this calendar year in sports is the way the Phoenix Suns have started this season. But we'll get to them when we get to the Western Conference. But Philly, 5-1, even with that loss against the Phoenix Suns last night, they're still playing well. They still look like one of the better teams in the Eastern Conference. Simmons and Embiid continue to just kind of settle into their new roles and get more comfortable and get ready to go here in this tight Eastern Conference. The Boston Celtics moving up two spots from fifth at the end of last week to third. They are now 4-1 on the season. Again, a team that is also just playing well with their core group of guys. They seem to be having fun. Tatum seems to be leading the way there and enjoying himself in Boston. And, I mean, what more can you say about the Celtics? This is a team that even though they lost some good guys with a two injury or just a free agency or whatever, this is a team that still has a good group, core group of players and are still playing really well in the Eastern Conference and have risen up to third and like the way they have continued to play this season in that conference. And then Milwaukee also jumping up two spots to fourth at a 5-2 record. This is a Milwaukee Bucks team that essentially goes as Antetokounmpo goes, and he's having a decent start to the year. You can see him. I think anybody that comes off an MVP season like that, it's always a bit of a tough start just because we look at the numbers they had from last season and we get so hyped and excited about that we kind of forget. It's a new season and new teams and new teammates and new matchups, but he's still playing really well. Milwaukee 5-2, sitting nice there in fourth place. And then we get to the middle four, right? That bottom four of the playoff picture, the middle four of the Eastern Conference, where we find our two biggest movers in the East this week. So right now, Toronto just moving down three spots to fifth. They're 4-2. Again, the top of this conference, pretty tight-knit. Toronto playing well, just letting a couple games get away from them. But 4-2, battling right now in fifth. But then we arrive at our first of the biggest movers in the Eastern Conference. Charlotte at 3-3 jumped up six spots from where they were last week. They were 12th at the end of week one, now sixth this week. Of course, the big 93-87 win over Golden State on Saturday, their last game that they've played. And they've looked really well this season. The Martin Twins have given them some good minutes. The Charlotte team continues to just essentially kind of defy the odds early in this year. Not a whole lot was expected from them, but Bridges, Rozier, all these guys playing really good games. And it's been exciting to watch. It's been fun to watch and see how they've gone this season. Zeller as well, giving them some good minutes. And then they did suffer a loss to the Clippers, 111-96, at the end of week one, but they've come into week two looking really well. They just had two games this past week on the Wednesday the 30th and Saturday the 2nd, but they won them both, 118-111 over the Kings and 93-87 over the Warriors. So it's a team that's been able to hold their own and look strong this year. They're getting a lot of good production from a couple different guys each night, so it's a team that isn't minding passing the ball around and sharing kind of the spotlight. And I think when you got some younger guys on here and just somebody that doesn't really stand out, Charlotte doesn't really have that one person that you really look at and go, that's the guy that's going to lead the way. I mean, Zeller, Bridges, Rozier, these are all guys that can step up and be team leaders, and I think they're showing that right now in Charlotte. And we'll see what they can do coming up this week. They have a game against Indiana at home tonight, then Boston on Thursday, then New Orleans on Saturday, so it could be a busy week for them, plus the 76ers on Sunday. So four games lining up for Charlotte this week against some top contenders there in that Eastern Conference. And speaking of Indiana, they are the other big mover. They are the biggest mover in the Eastern Conference, and thankfully they are moving the right way for them. They are up eight spots. They were 15th, dead last in the Eastern Conference after week one. They have now risen up to seventh in the Eastern Conference at a 3-3 record. And you look at the week they had, again, 3-0 this past week. On Wednesday the 30th, they beat Brooklyn 118-108, then picked up a win against Cleveland the next day, 102-95. And then at home on Sunday, beat Chicago 108-95. So this is a team that's playing really well. They're starting to get some good production out of Malcolm Brogdon as well as Warren. So this is a team that's playing really well, and they seem to have confidence in themselves either without Oladipo out there. This is a team that seems to have confidence in their offense, confidence in their defense, and they're playing really well. And then Brooklyn rounding out the playoff eight, up two spots at 3-4. And then run through the bottom of the conference real quick. Atlanta dropped five spots to ninth. Detroit dropped three spots to 10th. Orlando and Washington also dropped three spots to 11th and 12th, respectively. Cleveland dropped two spots to 13th. Chicago stayed in 14th. Then New York dropped two spots to dead last in the Eastern Conference with a 1-6 record. Now looking at the West, and a bit of a surprise, I think is fair to say. You have the two LA teams split by the Phoenix Suns. And the Lakers and the Suns are the two biggest movers in the Western Conference at the top of the conference. The Lakers up six spots to number one in the West with a 5-1 record, playing really, really well right now. And you would imagine so. This is a team, like I've talked about before, that seems like LeBron is A-OK with allowing Anthony Davis to step in and take control. And that was another interesting tidbit that's come out yesterday and this morning that I was reading, was Anthony Davis talking about a possible reunion with the Chicago Bulls, going back to his hometown of Chicago and playing there. He is a free agent after the year, so we'll see what comes of that. If he is possibly looking into that, he'll get to go to the United Center today, as the Lakers will play the Bulls at 5 o'clock Pacific time. And we'll see what kind of reaction he gets from the crowd. But I imagine with some of the talk going around right now, they could be very, very persuasive and maybe get some AD chance going there in the United Center tonight. But the Lakers, again, had a great year, great week themselves. Three games, three wins, 120-91 over Memphis, 119-110 in overtime over Dallas, and 103-96 over the Spurs on Sunday. So a team that, again, continues to play well. LeBron James, Anthony Davis's fingerprints are all over this team right now. Of course, Dwight Howard also able to get in there from game to game. And I think this is a load off Dwight as well, because I think thinking back to that first stint that Dwight Howard had with the Lakers, he didn't seem comfortable out there. It didn't seem like he really wanted to be there, which was weird. Because you think about some franchises throughout the NBA that you would want to play for, that are just historically you'd want to play for: Lakers, Celtics, Bulls, Knicks. So to see somebody that was so uncomfortable and looked like he just wanted to get out of LA, now his second stint there, again, with LeBron, with Anthony Davis, I feel like there's also some weight lifted off of Dwight Howard's shoulders that's allowing him to get a little more free with his play. But nonetheless, the Lakers up six spots into first. And then how do you like the Phoenix Suns? Seven games into the season, they are 5-2 with wins over the Clippers and the 76ers. Two of the better teams in the league heading into this year, and Phoenix has beaten both of them. In fact, they handed the Philadelphia 76ers their first loss on the season. This is a team that is playing with such a chip on their shoulder, and I can't get enough of it, especially Devin Booker. This kid is playing so well right now. Look at the three games they had this week, right? They beat Golden State on October 30th, 121-110, 31 points from Booker. 114-105 win over Memphis on Saturday, 21 points from Booker. Their 114-109 win last night against Philadelphia, 40 points from Booker. This is a guy who's had this talent, but because this team has chosen to tank the last 3 or 4 years, he hasn't been able to really go out there and explode and be this kind of a player. He now has that opportunity, and my gosh, is he taking advantage of it. And they'll have some great opportunity again this week with three games coming up. Thursday, they'll host Miami. Then Sunday, they host Brooklyn. And then Tuesday, a week from today, they will host the Lakers. So technically only two games coming up for the Suns this week with Miami and Brooklyn. But some more good opportunities for this team to get into a rhythm, more opportunities for this team to assert their dominance and show really how much of a contender they possibly can be this year in the West. Because this was so unexpected for Phoenix to have this kind of a start. And to have Miami and Brooklyn, the number one and number eight team right now in the conference, coming to Phoenix this week, I think it's going to be a great chance for them to really step up and show the kind of team they can be and how competitive, again, Monty Williams is allowing this team to be. Thank you, Monty Williams, for coming in here and allowing these guys to just play basketball. But Phoenix up seven spots to second, 5-2 right now, holding their own. I love it. The Clippers moved up a spot from fourth to third, also 5-2. Dallas moved up four spots to fourth at 4-2, making up the top four in the West. Minnesota dropped two spots to fifth. Denver dropped five spots to sixth, the team that was leading the Western Conference after week one, gone through a lot of struggles, now moving down to sixth. The Spurs moved down five spots. They were in second, now seventh. Houston dropped from sixth to eighth. You feel like there are those chemistry issues there with Houston. Westbrook didn't play, I think, their last game that they had, so who knows what's going on there. There seems to be chemistry issues and some confidence issues hitting Houston here early in the season. I hope that gets worked out. I'd like to see Harden and Westbrook be one of the more dominant duos. Not to say I like them to see them win a championship by any means, but I'd like to see them have a good year there in Houston and again make that team competitive. And then looking at the rest of the Western Conference here at the bottom, Utah dropped four spots to ninth. Portland stayed in 10th. OKC jumped up two spots to 11th. Golden State, although they did upset Portland last night or a couple nights ago, did not move. They stayed in 12th. Sacramento jumped up two spots to 13th. Memphis dropped three spots to 14th at 1-5. Then New Orleans dead last in the West at 1-6. But that is the way the NBA is stacking up after week two in the standings. Then, of course, LeBron James leading the way in assists in the NBA. James Harden is your offensive leader with 36 points a game. Andre Drummond, your defensive leader in rebounds with 19. Anthony Davis, leader in blocks. No surprise there with 3, although Kristaps Porzingis not too far behind him. And Ben Simmons with the best pair of happy hands with a little over 3 steals a game. And Karl-Anthony Towns, surprisingly enough, is leading 3-pointers made. Karl-Anthony Towns, Damian Lillard, and Kyle Lowry are top 3 in 3-pointers made. That shows you how much this league has changed from last year to this year. But that's where we are after 2 weeks of the NBA season. Week 3 gets started tonight, and just a great day for basketball today. Looking forward to that. And coming up after the break, I am going to give you my 2 cents worth on a certain NFL team who is being rumored to have been approached by the NFL with the idea of jumping across the pond. We'll talk about that after the break here on the Spencer Wilson Show on ESPN Radio, 94.5 FM.
Is your technology infrastructure meeting the demands of your customers, your employees, you? How does your network scale to support your growth plans? With distribution hiding behind every corner, it's time you benefited from a network and security provider that will guide your organization through rapid technology change. Blackfoot, here to enable what's next. Visit blackfoot.com/SDWAN to learn more.
So I'm laying in bed last night, minding my own business, you know, hanging out, watching SportsCenter, and I get this alert on my phone. I look down, it's from one of my apps, and I'm opening it up, and all I see is the headline, and I nearly lost it, because the headline read, "Are the Chargers on the move to London?" And I nearly threw my phone across my bedroom, because why in God's name would you put any NFL team in London? Like, if you want to put a new NFL team, a startup, a new NFL team in London, that's great. But to take any of the 32 that are established within the United States, within the NFL, and to move them over to London is one of the dumbest ideas I've heard in quite some time. And I mean, what's a bummer about this and what's a bummer about the Chargers being the center of this talk, first off, Spanos came out today and said absolutely not. It's effing BS is essentially what he said, which makes me feel very happy. Because being a Charger fan, it was incredibly tough to watch them leave San Diego and go to L.A. And the reason why that was so tough is because L.A. didn't want them and San Diego didn't care enough to keep them. And now they're playing at a soccer stadium in Carson, California. So, it's been tough, really, since the announcement came down that they were going to move to Los Angeles. And I never thought that I would look to Jerry Jones for comfort in any way, shape, or form throughout my entire adult life as a fan or as a person in general. I never thought I would look to Jerry Jones for comfort. But even he came out and said, no, that move isn't viable. Which, of course, it isn't. Imagine the scheduling that you're going to have to plan out. A 16-game schedule where you have to send 8 teams over to London to play a game and then have the Chargers travel 8 different times to the back to the U.S. to play a game. That is going to give so many people a headache. I hate to say this, but if that's the idea, you might as well just, you know, cancel the franchise. That would be a smarter move than moving them over to London. I mean, where do you even get the idea that would be half as smart? I mean, are you kidding me? Moving a team to London? Ugh. So anyway, I was freaking out in my bed last night. Because I was like, this is the dumbest move. And this is a franchise that is scrambling to try and find something to hang on to. And there was no way Rivers is going to go with him to London. I would imagine that half the players on that team wouldn't want to move all the way to London to play 8 games a year there. That's essentially it. You're picking up everything you've settled here in the United States, moving it to London for 8 games in a 12-month period. Maybe 9 or 10 if you get to host a playoff game over there. Otherwise, it seems like such a far stretch and such a dumb idea. And I'm happy that Spanos came out and said no. I'm happy that Jerry Jones, with all his influence, came out and said no, this isn't happening. I mean, if I had my wish, I would send the Chargers right back down to San Diego. You know? The tough thing is that city just doesn't want him. They lost touch. The Chargers kind of lost touch. Their last few years in San Diego was like living with your ex-wife. They're there, but you don't really care what they're doing. You see them. They're walking around the house, care less. And L.A., I mean, with the Rams' success last year, making it to the Super Bowl, not having the same amount of success this year, but that team with its young stars from quarterback to defense, I mean, that they're a team that's getting more of the L.A. attention. When that SoFi Stadium opens up the next year, the year after, man, I hope the Chargers have a team that can contend and get some excitement going. Because the way the Chargers season is going now, they're not bringing anybody in. They're not going to get anybody into that stadium if they can't just get a fan base, get some passion. You got to think of something. You got to get something. You got to do something different. And a move to London is not the right move. But that's the show. Thank you so much for tuning in. I hope you enjoyed it. We'll talk tomorrow. Peace.